On that happy note, so first I've got to explain that the title and abstract were constructed in a big hurry in Tony's office on Monday, me dictating, Tony entering. It came out a little stronger than I intended. I am very impressed with the successes of the now standard cosmology. What I intend to describe are some perhaps details, aspects of the phenomenology that to me just don't seem to make sense within the standard model. I think they're serious enough problems that they're going to drive adjustments of the standard cosmology, perhaps very simple fine-tuning, perhaps something more serious, we'll see. In this connection, I draw your attention to this budget for mass in the present universe. 5% baryons, traces of neutrinos, radiation, 95% in the dark sector, apportioned roughly 1/4 low pressure matter, 3/4 stuff that acts like Einstein's cosmological constant, in effect pressure equal to minus energy density. This sector admits of all the spectacular complexity of you people. The physics, wonderfully elegant and simple, but capable of complex behavior. This sector, capable of nothing, dull, simple, no complex behavior. Let us observe why this is. Here, in speculating on the physics, we are working in the dark. And we therefore postulate the simplest physics we can get away with. That's good science. But I think it would be a grave philosophical mistake to imagine that because we prefer simplicity of what we can't see, it's really that way. If it is not simple, we will discover that by finding discordances between the phenomenology and what the theory says. That is why I think we should be very interested in these small discrepancies. Now, on one final point on discussion. I am told that I may not take as my first goal that of annoying all of my colleagues in cosmology by raising doubts, but rather it is to entertain the rest of you people. Now, I must admit, I could imagine it would be very entertaining for you to watch my colleagues tear me apart. But I think it's not edifying, and so I propose I would be very happy to have questions, but keep them short. And if you want to get into details, I hope we can get together separately and discuss them then. My real hope is that by airing these thoughts, which are here assembled by me for the first time, I will perhaps learn myself and perhaps get others to think about ways to better organize these thoughts and perhaps interpret them. I warn you, I will not have any interpretations. These are just weird things. I begin by presenting to you a very familiar and old weird thing. Spiral galaxies like our own have disks that are quite thin, in which the gas and the stars usually rotate in very close to circular motion. If the disk is inclined to the plane of the sky, you can use a Doppler effect to get velocity as a function of position, measure the velocity of rotation as a function of radius, and then go to very elementary physics. V squared over r gives you the acceleration. If the mass distribution is spherical, that gives you the mass contained within that radius. If asymmetric, there's a geometrical correction, but it's uninteresting, a detail. Here are measurements of the circular velocities as a function of radius for two galaxies, two spiral galaxies. The dots are the measurements. The solid curve is the circular velocity you would expect if the mass were in the galaxy, in the stars alone, and the stars have a characteristic, have the typical ratio of star mass to star light. You see that if all we had was this, then we would be all happy. What you see is what you get. The universe is made of stars. You see here something bizarre. The contribution to the circular velocity by the stars is dropping. The contribution by the postulated dark matter must be rising in just such a way as to hold this crazy thing flat and to blend in very smoothly at the center with the circular velocity due to stars alone. This used to have the name, maybe still does, it isn't so much discussed anymore, a conspiracy. It may happen just by accident. But here I propose that we keep in mind one of Einstein's principles, which I adjust to the statement, nature is subtle but not malevolent. If we see lots of such curiosities, we will start to think that nature is being malevolent to us, and that is, I think, a good signal that we're missing something subtle. Okay, so that's the philosophy of this talk. I go on now to the first, this is the first malevolence, to the second malevolence. Oh, yes, it is. If we accept standard physics, we need the halos. The point is how flat it is. It is flat because of conspiracy, because the distribution of dark mass and luminous mass just happens to work that way. A conspiracy. Also, that there is this smooth blending in. That is conspiracy number one. So now, conspiracy number two. An elaborate story, bear with me. Here is the distribution in Cartesian coordinates of all galaxies within a fixed distance of us inside a cubical box with us at the center. Can I write here, well, not everyone will see it, that one, I want to introduce a bit of notation. One has the observed wavelength of a spectral feature. One has the wavelength at emission, as measured in the laboratory. One defines this as 1 plus the redshift. The redshift multiplied by the velocity of light is in effect a velocity of recession, which is proportional to distance. Because this constant of proportionality is not well known, I'm going to be discussing redshifts as measured by distances. So these redshifts go out at the edge of the box relative to the center, about 250 kilometers per second, a number. Inside this region, you see the clumpy distribution of galaxies. The size of the symbol is proportional to the luminosity of the galaxy. You see there are big ones and little ones, an enormous range. Well explored here because these things are so close, virtually, they're right on top of us. And I draw your attention to the difference between these two projections. Here we see a clumpy distribution. Here in this projection, they're pretty well lined up to a sheet. The coordinates in which you see this close to flat distribution of galaxies are called supergalactic coordinates, named by Gerard de Vaucouleurs in the 1950s, who was shrewd enough even then to sort out this remarkably flat distribution. Okay, now we go out a factor of about 10 in distance. Here is the distribution over the whole sky of galaxies that are bright in the far infrared because they've got lots of dust that is absorbing lots of starlight, re-radiating it. This is full sky, flattened out. These are all galaxies out to a redshift 3,000 kilometers per second. About 10 times of that. The extreme dwarfs seen over there are missing, they're too faint. Galaxies that don't have much gas are also missing, they don't radiate in the infrared. There is a little strip along here. This is a strip of galaxies de Vaucouleurs noticed, and it was this strip that he called the local supercluster, and these supergalactic coordinates were chosen to align with that strip. Now, I go out another factor of 2 in distance. Here, all galaxies between 3,000 kilometers per second and 6,000, we've lost the local supercluster. It just looks like a near homogeneous mess. Here, in the last, yet another coordinate system, is the distribution of nearby radio galaxies. Galaxies in which matter is clumped in toward the center, one presumes made a black hole. More material falling into the black hole as it got squeezed very hard, caused explosions that make radio emission that are detectable then as radio galaxies. Here are all radio galaxies out to 7,000 kilometers per second. That's just slightly deeper than that map. Here is the de Vaucouleurs plane of the local supercluster here is the full space up to this radius, and where are all these radio sources? They're in the plane. Go out from 7,000 to 10,000, just somewhat beyond this map, the sources are all over the place. Now, what in the world is going on here? Why should the galaxies that tend to explode be lined up in the plane that is defined by our immediate neighborhood, yet galaxies, by and large, are all over the place? Now, we have a partial explanation of this, or rather, further description of the phenomenon. Here, in the same coordinates as this, is a full sky map showing all of the nearby clusters of galaxies, those places where the galaxy concentration gets really, really dense. These clusters are all so close that they've got names. They're our friends. Where do they sit? This, in these horribly distorted coordinates, is the plane of the local supercluster, Gerard de Vaucouleurs' plane, and there the clusters sit. The connection to this effect, which should be called the Peter Shaver effect, he's noticed it. It's never referred to in the literature. I mean, it's obscene. This is silly. But there it is, a real phenomenon, unless it's been renegotiated. Where's Stephen Myers? Has it been renegotiated? It's a real effect. I mean, how could you miss? These things are all famous radio sources, too. They're the nearby ones. Giant radio galaxies tend to be in clusters, at least in the center. And so there's a connection, surely, between the tendency of these guys to be in the plane and these guys to be in the plane, although there are a lot more of these guys than there are rich clusters nearby. So what's going on? What's going on? The immediate thought is it's pancake collapse. If you have a very smooth distribution of matter but with long wavelength fluctuations and let it go, it will tend to collapse into a cusp-like distribution, a pancake. But we don't see a pancake. Now, there is a note. These are the gas-rich galaxies. These guys are all gas-poor galaxies because they're in a dense region, a region of high plasma density. The gas is swept out. These guys are not IRS galaxies. To be discovered, it will come out of Sloan and other surveys, is whether if you make this map for early-type gas-free galaxies alone, you'll see some evidence of a pancake. But even if it's a pancake, why the devil should the radio galaxies care about a splashy, messy pancake collapse? You know, what more appeals to me is the thought, remember in the good old days there were cosmic strings with tension equal to minus the energy per unit length? A beautiful idea within particle physics. They happen not to have any gravity, but they do have an angle deficit. The circumference isn't 2 pi r. It means that if you draw one of these strings through me, I don't feel a thing except that my head and my feet acquire a velocity together and I'm soon squashed. It's a very unhealthy thing to do. If I had taken one of these cosmic strings and drawn it through our neighborhood back at high redshift, and if I kept the string nice and straight, I would form a thin sheet of matter that, for all I know, makes these concentrations. Something's going on here. I can't believe that this is simply a statistical artifact. But it's such a bizarre phenomenon, I can't believe it comes out of the standard cosmology. That is my second conspiracy. You see that, according to the Einstein principle, I should be asking myself whether this is malevolence or are we missing something subtle. But I'll pause for a minute for brief comments, mainly from the non-experts. But no, the experts should say something too. Well, I remind myself what I was going to talk about next.
Phil.
Phil Lubin.
You asked a different analysis of it. I'm not exactly sure how I do, because there's a lot of uncertainty.
I have not done this, but do you really think this is a statistical fluke? What does your heart say?
There's a lot of things that are weird that can be.
Yeah.
I mean, we're weird, right?
Yeah, we are. But we're naturally selected.
This one?
No, this is distance from the plane. This guy hits the plane here and is this far above it. And this guy hits the plane here and is this far below it, if you see what I mean. These lines are short, these lines are long. And it doesn't look like a statistical fluke. The big problem with doing statistics, of course, is that this is a sample of one. We will have no other sample of the universe that can be investigated in this detail. So we take this or we leave it.
We have many samples of parts of the universe back there.
Yes. The trouble is here we have exquisite control on distances. We know who's near us and who's far. At any greater distance from us, relative distances get terribly uncertain. I have not been able to get any sensible person to actually look because it's such a ridiculous phenomenon. And of course, N-body people can't tell me. Oh, I always have to apologize. I didn't mean to put Peter Shaver's name upside down. It was not malevolence. How do you model this? How do you model the formation of radio galaxies? Well, this is great. Please. Yes.
If the radio properties are triggered by the same thing that puts them in a pancake, then you're just not seeing the
yes.
That aren't there, and then once it gets there, you take on the radio broadcast.
Yes. Somehow, environment perhaps is playing a role. Environment on the scale of intergalaxy distances is playing a role in triggering the phenomenon down in the nucleus of the galaxy. One doesn't know what that would be, but that is one description.
Yeah, but it's also not heard of, I think, in talking about radio galaxies, aside from supposing it to the phenomenon.
Well, radio galaxies, I don't know. Are radio galaxies correlated with environment?
Other than the ones liking to be in clusters.
Yeah, the super ones liking to be in clusters, which is to say this phenomenon and this phenomenon are really saying much the same thing. Each of these will have a central giant galaxy that will be a radio source.
Well, but there, one thing that might be possible also is that it doesn't look equally distributed in the plane.
Oh no. There is of course great clustering. A knot here, nobody here much, and then another knot. There is strong clustering. But in the plane. I think I should turn now to another issue, one in which there is a pretty definite prediction from the standard cold dark matter model. This is the question of when the galaxies formed, at what redshift. I should here remind you of another relation. This redshift, this ratio of wavelengths, 1 plus z, is in the standard cosmology also the ratio of the present value of the universe's expansion parameter divided by the expansion parameter at emission. Which is to say, if the redshift is 1, then the universe has doubled in size. Redshift is 3, the universe is increased by a factor of 4 in linear dimensions. So now, here is a prediction within the cold dark matter model of the number density of galaxies after taking account of the general expansion. Right? So if galaxies were permanent entities, this would be a horizontal line. It is saying that in the now standard model, please focus on the dotted lines, the number of galaxies with star mass 10 to the 10th is down by a factor of 10 at a redshift of 1, at a redshift of 3, down by maybe 3 orders of magnitude. galaxy formation is relatively late, or rather galaxy building is relatively late in this model for a simple reason. The numerical simulations that describe galaxy formation say that when two galaxies get close together, they merge into one galaxy. So there is, as the universe expands, concentrations of galaxies form and merge to make bigger galaxies that form into concentrations that merge to make still bigger galaxies. Hierarchical galaxy formation by merging. This is tested by many simulations. It is the standard model. Furthermore, it is unquestioned that galaxies do merge. Here is a photograph of an ugly event. This is the nearest large elliptical galaxy. It's at about a redshift of 300. It is, of course, in the supergalactic plane. It's in a small group of spiral galaxies. It has across it an ugly gash. Dark because a spiral galaxy full of dust has just landed on it. I think it is convincing that this thing is splashed onto the elliptical. It has been eaten. Galaxy merging happens. The big question is, what is the rate at which galaxy merging happens? We start to explore this by looking at another example of what is considered to be proto-merging. Here are images of galaxies in a great cluster at a redshift 0.8, roughly a redshift of unity, roughly the universe has doubled in size since the light from these galaxies was emitted. These exquisite images are from Hubble Space Telescope. The fuzzy nature of these images is not due to resolution, it's due to the fact that these are fuzzy gas spheres, like ordinary looking elliptical galaxies, with one big difference. There's an unusual number of close pairs. It's a little hard to see here, but there are two bright spots, two and maybe three. Within the standard cosmology, these are mergers in progress. By the time these pair have rotated once, they've merged. Hence these observers, very careful and serious people, have called them merger events. But, and I should just point out that we're very sure these aren't accidental projections, two galaxies that are far apart but happen to be seen close, because of when the people who do these observations count the number of galaxy pairs as a function of separation, they see a spike at about 10 kiloparsecs, which is about 3 times the half-light radius of a galaxy. These are cases where two galaxies are really right close together. The spike tells us these are physical, not Poisson noise. Now, the hooker here is that in the old days, back, I bet, when Marion Franks and the others who made these measurements were not yet born, two astronomers named Mitch Strubel and Herbert Rood noticed that in nearby great clusters of galaxies, those things that were sitting almost on top of us, some of them have curiously large numbers of pairs of galaxies. Through the magic of the internet, I got an image of the field of one of the Strubel-Rood clusters. And through the help of Strubel and Rood's paper, I circled the pairs. You can't see it, but these are also pairs with very similar separation sizes to these guys. Now here is the conundrum. How did it come about that in this cluster there are so many pairs? Of course, the first question, again, Phil, has to be, are these really physical pairs? It would be easy to check. In fact, what you should do is measure the redshift of every galaxy in that cluster, and then you should look at the distance to the nearest neighbor in projected separation and velocity difference, and ask whether you see a spike at small velocity difference and small projected separation. Hasn't been done. But I mean, you got to trust people like Strubel and Rude. These people are compulsive. They really study galaxies. They know them and they love them. And I don't think they'd have pointed this out unless there's a good chance it's a real phenomenon. Now the question is, how is it that in these late times there are still lots of binary pairs in this cluster? Under standard numerical simulations and standard, although simple-minded, theory, these guys will merge very quickly. They should not still be present. Therefore, if that theory is correct, these guys must have recently formed and are in the process of merging. That's a little bit of a puzzle because the relative velocities in this cluster would be a couple of thousand kilometers per second. The internal velocity is a couple of hundred. Under conventional ideas, if two of these approach each other, they'll just pass on through. They won't care. So how do they form? And if they did form at a sufficient rate to keep replacing the binaries that are here, we have a separate problem. We're going to grow galaxies at a pretty prodigious rate in clusters that, so far as we can tell, contain galaxy masses not dissimilar from the galaxy masses seen here. There are even more details that I maybe hesitate to get into in a private and in a public conversation such as this, but let me just mention one of them. Elliptical galaxies are a remarkably uniform set of guys. In particular, there is a nice correlation between the luminosity of the galaxy and its color. If you go building galaxies by rapid merging, as would be required to account for these pairs if merging is common, then you are making big galaxies out of little ones, and how do you preserve the color magnitude relation? It's ugly. Let us leave the situation at this, a feeling of nervousness, at least on my part, on rapid merging as in the standard model, and go on to the question, what accounts of galaxies as a function of redshift? Are galaxies really evolving as quickly as is suggested in this plot? I should say, because I'm going to get rather nasty at this point, we should not hold these people too tightly to their prediction. Because to make this prediction is very difficult. They have to introduce lots of parameters by hand to describe what they hope is a realistic fashion, astrophysics that is very messy. On the other hand, they're serious people. They wouldn't have drawn this plot if they didn't think there's pretty good reason to believe that the CDM model really does predict this. So let's ask. So we turn to data on how galaxies evolve in number and mass with redshift. Now, this is a game that is only now being played in to any extent. Find a faint galaxy at high redshift, measure its spectrum, and from the spectrum, estimate its star mass. How massive is it? How many stars does it contain? Here's an example of what these guys have to do. They have these measurements of luminosity as a function of wavelength, running from the infrared, here's 2 microns and still longer, into the ultraviolet. Now, take a standard assembly of stars of the kind you think typically form when stars form, mixture of masses, compute the luminosity. Notice that these galaxies may be expected to contain old stars and young stars. The young stars have their luminosity dominated by massive stars that evolve quickly, that are very blue. So a young star population is a lot more luminous and a lot bluer. The game they have to play is to decide how many old stars and young stars must be added together to fit these observations. You notice that they have a very loose handle only on the old star population. There is 1.7 times as much mass in the old population as in the young, but of course the light of the old population is a minor perturbation on the light of the young. Okay, so it's a dicey game, but these are brave people. They have played it. Here, the horizontal axis is redshift, but so adjusted that the volume of space, ignoring the expansion of the universe, is linear on this axis. So if the number density of galaxies is conserved, that is to say, if galaxies are conserved, we should see a uniform density of points along here. Now, one other technicality, in this particular plot, they have fitted only to the young population, ignoring the hint of an old population. That's okay here because it's mostly old, but here, they have fitted to one population, one age of all of the stars. That's okay here. Over here, they're picking up the young stars. They might have a correction due to the old stars that would push these numbers up. But they say, we think it's a modest effect. Now, let us consider what the theory is saying. Let us focus on galaxies with a star mass of 10 to the 10th. The Milky Way has a star mass of about 5 × 10^10. It would be on a trajectory that's over here somewhere. Focus on the dotted line, that's a standard model. Go to a redshift of 3. Yeah, it's 3. And notice that from here to here, we've gone down about 1, 2, 3 orders of magnitude, give or take change. Now look here at 10^10. What is the ratio of the number density here to the number density here? Well, it looks lower here, but we should be careful because they haven't counted the old star population. But does it look 3 orders of magnitude lower? But the theorists are saying no, so it must be all right. Nobody is objecting, which is to say they've probably fallen asleep. But I will push on. Let's do another game. Oh, and I should remark that if galaxies all were made in the very distant past, their star mass would evolve. The Milky Way disk contains stars with a broad range of ages. Star formation is continuing. It's going on at roughly a linear rate. At redshift 3, if the Milky Way were already present, its star mass in the disk would be maybe 20% of the present mass, because we know that star formation is an ongoing process. It would be down then, here, at about 5 × 10^10, at a redshift of 3, around 10^10. There is galaxy evolution, even if galaxies are old. Now, the amount of evolution can be measured in the following way. Very difficult measurements just now underway. I should have remembered to emphasize that these are spectacularly small fields. Because galaxy distribution is clumpy, there is no assurance that this is a fair sample. But here are measurements not from space, but rather from a European Very Large Telescope, in which one measures at 2.2 microns wavelength in the infrared, a good thing to do because you're looking for distant galaxies, their light is shifted toward the red. So, integrate the hell out of the sky in large fields to pick up all of the objects that are brighter than a given limit at 2.2 microns. Then work even harder to measure the redshifts. These measurements, the data are the same all the way across, took an enormous amount of time. Even so, they didn't get as faint as the Hubble Deep Field, but Dickinson, one of the people on the previous paper who used the Hubble Deep Field, the Hubble Space Telescope, says he is deeply impressed by the deep depth they've reached. I have not heard a lot of quibbles about the redshifts, which are also hard to measure. So let's take this data at face value and notice some models. Here are semi-analytic model predictions of the sort that come out of the standard cosmology. You notice there is a divergence of opinion. These are difficult calculations involving many assumptions. But you notice one clear and present danger. Because galaxies are assembled late by merging, there are not massive galaxies in great abundance at higher redshift. Everybody agrees these guys shouldn't be there. And because galaxies form late, there ought to be lots at low redshift relative to higher redshift. There weren't as many then. So they agree on a relatively late peak, which seems to be inconsistent with these data. Here, on the other hand, are models in which one makes the galaxies at very high redshift, and then one takes note of the fact that elliptical type galaxies have uniformly old star populations, so let them just evolve passively. Don't make any stars in them. Spirals like the Milky Way have ongoing star formation. That's modeled by a very simple recipe for an exponential decay in star formation with time. There are lots of parameters. You see lots of different model predictions. The one message one should take away is, I can turn the crank on the parameters to fit the data. Again, I should emphasize, we shouldn't hold these people too tightly to their predictions. They've got parameters too, and they didn't know about these measurements. But one thing for sure, the late galaxy formation that has been so heavily advertised in the standard cosmology, I think didn't happen. It's just not there. Give me a break. Why do you keep talking about merging and late galaxy formation? That's not the way it is. Am I over the top? Isn't there a discrepancy here between theory and observation? Or, well,
is the location the spike in redshift?
That spike, remember, galaxies, some galaxies are in very massive clusters. This is a cluster of galaxies. In fact, it's two that happen to be in the field. There is therefore noise, and you could ask me, how do I know this isn't noise? My answer is simple, I don't. We will see whether further measurements show whether the general trend is reproducible or whether there is more fluctuation than I think.
All of those models are done in the quote-unquote standard cosmology.
This is all lambda CDM. Well,
so we need to say for the condensed matter control what lambda CDM means?
Yeah, I did, actually. Well. No, I mean, I didn't use the words, but the song was there. Remember, I started by remarking that in the standard model, baryons have about 5% of the mass of the universe, trace elements, neutrinos, electromagnetic radiation. There is a dark matter, non-baryonic, that seems to be around galaxies. That's about 20% of the mass. The rest, about 75%, is in a cosmological constant or something like X like it. That's lambda. Lambda CDM is the assumption, I might as well say it, that the universe is cosmologically flat, its energy is dominated by lambda, or the equivalent. The next dominant contribution is dark matter that is non-baryonic, has zero pressure, and a primeval mass distribution that's described by one function of one position, the power spectrum, near scale invariant. Let's not get into the details of what that means. A remarkable concept that the initial conditions for structure formation are prescribed by one function of one variable, the power spectrum of a random Gaussian process. Out of that grew this room. The ultimate emergent phenomenon. Something like that. That is the standard cosmology that everyone is talking about these days. But it makes predictions that look fishy. I have not been fair to the lambda CDM model by emphasizing the predictions that look good. But that's a different talk.
Well, I mean, lambda CDM tells you about halo merging.
Yes, it does.
You have to then associate those pesky baryons, which you see over here.
Yes, yes. Of course, the people who make these simulations worry endlessly about that. Let's go on to another aspect of galaxy formation that, again, seems to me fishy. Shall I? as far as the abundance of rich clusters goes, so far everything looks fine. So far as the abundance of halos goes, well, I don't know the answer, because people always talk about galaxies placed in halos. I don't hear so much about where the halos are. My last topic, you'll be glad to hear. I'll speed up a bit. Has to do with biasing. Now, I show you transparency that's approaching 20 years of age. Many of my younger colleagues get quite annoyed with me. Why do you show these grotesque yellowing transparencies? And my only response is, why do you keep forgetting these phenomena? So here is a game I wish to draw your attention to. Take a slice of the sky 6 degrees deep and about that wide, and plot in its pizza diagram the angular position of each galaxy along the stripe and in the radial direction the redshift of the galaxy. Here were data available in the early 1980s, 1982 I believe it was. They illustrate the general Compi distribution of matter. Margaret Geller, Galerie de Leparant, and I guess John Huckra made the bold step. I advised them with great sense and sensibility, don't sample densely, take sparse sampling, we just want to measure statistics. Margaret said, no, I want to see what it really looks like. Here is a denser sampling of the same strip of sky, including simply less luminous galaxies. You notice what happened in here, a structure that after the fact you can see was present in skeletal form emerges. They weren't content with that, so they went still deeper in the same bit of sky and got this. The crosses are the faintest of the galaxies. You will see that occasionally a cross appears in the middle of nowhere. But far more frequently, the crosses just burn into the paper, right? This thing is totally black with crosses on top of triangles. Now, what is happening here is, I think, very deep. As you go down into the luminosity function to fainter and fainter galaxies, you find that the galaxies continue to sit on each other. Big galaxies like to be where little galaxies are. I offer a couple more examples of this phenomenon. This example. Here are the distribution of galaxies in a thin slice next to us. Close enough that you can well measure the morphology of each galaxy, and you can sample way down into the luminosity function. Here are elliptical galaxies. Where are some elliptical galaxies? Ellipticals. S0s are spirals that don't have any gas in them. Early type spirals are spirals that have a little gas. Late type spirals are spirals that have a lot of gas. Black dots are all of the miserable remnants, dwarfs, irregulars, yucky things. And do you notice something very striking? Everybody is here and nobody's up there. Another example. Here is the spectrum of perhaps one of the oddest galaxies in the books. This galaxy is a knot of stars surrounded by a cloud of atomic hydrogen. This is the spectrum of the galaxy. It's a spectrum of those stars. It has a great notch here at Lyman alpha resonance absorption line, slightly redshifted from the local Lyman alpha resonance. It is record breadth. Now, typically, in a galaxy, when you see gas, hydrogen, you see heavy elements and with them dust. And if the surface density of hydrogen required to cut open this trough were of the usual composition, you wouldn't have seen this galaxy because there would have been too much dust. You typically don't see this much hydrogen, because when it's that much, it's obscured by dust. Here, you see it loud and clear. You see absorption lines of common elements, but they're minuscule. This is a cloud of almost primeval composition. It's charming. It is the best approximation we have to a galaxy that has just decided to form out of primeval gas. It's a wonderful object. Now we ask ourselves, where is it? Its position is in that little box. It's very characteristic. It's not in a dense region, but it's not out where nobody else is. Galaxies like each other. Now, blah, 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 I just cannot resist this quote from people who look for galaxies by their hydrogen 21 centimeter hyperfine structure line. The void galaxies that they do discover seem to be unaware of the fact that they exist in a huge underdense region. Earlier we were commenting on the influence of environment, and it's real. Galaxies in dense regions tend to have not much gas. But that is a rather a second order effect. By and large, the occasional galaxy you see in a void looks like any other galaxy. It's unaware of the fact of its environment. Pretty striking fact. Now, let us turn to the CDM model and some simulations, of which anyone who has attended many cosmology talks, a few cosmology talks, surely has seen such plots. This from Simon White and his student Hugh Mathis, showing a typical situation. This is a region of generally high overdensity in the original Gaussian process, and it managed to make big things. This is a region of overall low density. What did it make? It made little things. You notice the very qualitative, but to me, manifest property of this system. I would look for a galaxy that's just getting its act together and forming here. It's all alone, its density is low, it can take all the time in the world to suddenly collapse and start making a few stars just at the present time. I wouldn't look for it in here, but yet you saw that galaxy that was newly formed, well, was somewhere in a region like this. The giants and the dwarfs seem to be misplaced. Here I do in fact have a statistical analysis to present, alas, woefully incomplete. Here is one analysis one can make of this effect, this tendency for giants and dwarfs to like to be near each other. I notice that only half of you can see the blackboard, so now this is your big chance to see what I'm writing. One has a distribution of giants and one has a distribution of dwarfs. And one asks whether the giants cluster with the dwarfs or do the dwarfs tend to avoid the giants. One measure is to ask, if you sit on a dwarf, what's the distance to the nearest giant? Now we've got to have a control. And there's an easy one. When you sit on a giant, what's the distance to the nearest giant? The distributions will be the same, of course, if the giants and dwarfs have the same underlying statistical distribution. If dwarfs tend to avoid giants, the distances from giant to dwarf will be larger than the distance from giant to giant. Here, this dwarf doesn't have anybody for a long way. It's getting late. We're getting bored. Please ignore the dotted lines, their controls. The broken and solid lines are, and I don't even remember which is which, frequency distribution of distance to nearest giant from a dwarf and the nearest giant from a giant. And it's a mixed bag. Simon White and his student looked at the same thing. I didn't get around to making a transparency because it's too depressing. The model doesn't match the real world in the sense that you see that at a factor of three down from the peak, we're out at about 100 kilometers per second. In these things, we're out at about 300 or 400 kilometers per second. The distribution of distances just isn't comparable. So the comparison gets dull, and I won't make it. We have then, I think, yet another example of something that just doesn't make sense to me. the phenomena seem so reproducible and so out of line with what I would expect from this as a realization of our world. The big issues, number one, are these voids where there just isn't anybody, truly empty. If not, if they contain the debris that one would expect from the debris left between the concentrations in the simulations, if that debris is there, why the devil doesn't it show up? It's an excellent problem for those of you who study astrophysics to determine. My bet is these things look empty because they are empty. And then we have the great challenge of understanding why are these things not empty? The possibilities, number one, because you chose the wrong initial conditions. They should have been non-Gaussian. I raise that with the greatest of trepidation because the microwave background fluctuations, as far as I know, are pretty close to Gaussian. On scales, well, here this scale is about, in fact, this is about the size, the co-moving size of the Hubble length at decoupling of matter and radiation. This is where you have a pretty good sample of density fluctuations back then, just on a scale where we've got these stupid voids and concentrations. To make these voids out of non-Gaussian initial conditions is, my guess is, not on. And if that's not on, what is left? I hesitate to say it, but no, I don't hesitate at all. I think it's clear. The dark sector is more complicated than the simplest model. That would surely not be a surprise. I have searched in the literature for the anthropic principle for any reason to think that nature would have made the dark sector simple. Now, of course, it could be. It doesn't have to be complicated because we don't depend on the dark sector. We wouldn't be here if the visible sector didn't allow complexity. I don't think we care. Our survival doesn't depend on complexity in the dark sector, but could it be there?
But you certainly will. Literature didn't come up with the 10 different particle physics candidates for dark matter.
No, it didn't. It didn't. You tell me a candidate for dark matter physics that would help solve this problem. I will be delighted to join you on the paper.
I thought you said there were no.
There are. Okay. Yeah. What I'm proposing is interacting dark matter, and I think it isn't as simple as give it a cross section. I think you're going to have something more complicated. Something more complicated than a cross section would be, for example, a fifth force. You guys instruct me that there is great hazard in avoiding fifth forces, particularly if we attempt to describe the dark energy as out of a field, then there is a great hazard of fifth forces. But if it's a fifth force not in the visible sector, but in the dark sector, you have a lot more freedom. And for all I know, you have a possible way out of these binds. Katie.
As you know, we've been playing around with what we call Cardassian extension, which is an example of what you're describing. So the dark energy is just matter, and we're trying now to describe it as a fluid.
But with curious properties. And I think the general philosophical point is, why should there not be new phenomena in the dark sector? Perhaps oddball fluids, perhaps fifth forces. I've run out of time, more or less, and I've run out of energy, so I'm going to stop here. Thank you.
Very complicated lattice calculations. scale number, this is really the observation of the experiment, and then decide that there must be a problem with the calculation. What did you reasonably believe that there was a problem with the structure of the underlying TDM model, as opposed to what the problem with the underlying model?
It's an excellent point. I did try to say it a couple of times. The computations I described within CDM are very messy and susceptible to big errors. The people who make these calculations don't take lightly suggestions of the sort you raise. But that's okay. They wouldn't have gotten as far as they had if they hadn't been deeply committed to that particular line of approach. But you might be right. You might be right. Whether that can solve the galaxy formation problem, which I think is manifest, is not at all clear to me. I wouldn't say they can't. Whether it can solve the void problem is, again, hotly debated. I find it a little harder to see how this can be an error in the computations. This shows the identified clumps of dark matter. There are other maps, I'm sure you've seen them many times, in which you see all of the dark matter. Here you see a general sheen of stuff running between these threads, running between the concentrations. That seems like a pretty clean prediction. I might be wrong, but I have trouble seeing how the prediction of debris in the voids could be misled. Here, of course, the big debate is not about the simulations, but about the real world. Are the voids really empty?
David?
He's given up.
Question? Ben?
So, in all this, the rituals are important. The
Yes, yes.
So there's a lot of physics.
A lot of messy, complicated astrophysics in between. That's right. Yes. I quite agree. It could be that the discrepancy is not in the modeling of CDM, but rather in its interpretation in terms of the observations. It could be true, but you know, I've given you my prize examples. You have to decide whether you think there are enough of those examples that the Einstein principle may be applied.
Question over here, and then
To follow up on Mark's point, more than just assuming that the numerical simulations may be wrong, there is a long history, it seems to me, because of all relatively long, since numerical simulations have been done in the last 25 or 30 years.
Yes.
Of exactly that, of finding the simulation seems to point something different to the observations, and then discovering what it is about the simulations that you're not including or misinterpreting.
You're absolutely right. Going back to the first, the ones I did are okay. But there were some that gave quite misleading results. Fair enough. Do you think that this is a flaw in the simulations?
It's a nice picture. How it relates to that is something that
then that's in all of this phenomenology.
Let's see, if I remember the argument, or I mean, it seems to me what you're pointing to is that there's some interaction in the dark matter.
In the broadest sense.
Interaction in the dark matter sector. And actually, Mark, at Cosmo, he gave a beautiful talk which gave a lot of evidence against that. But I remember that one of the main motivations was Cusp in the Murray Galaxy.
Yes, I didn't.
I don't think that.
Oh, no, I do. But it's something that everyone's discussing. I guess I didn't explain that I meant this to be forgotten problems. Isn't it fair? I believe most people do not regard this stuff as a problem because they don't think about it too much. With the exception, I guess, of the redshift of galaxy formation, and there people aren't very nervous for reasons that totally escape me.
Questions especially from non-experts and from students?
So you're claiming that you think that
structure to create void planes, or whether those voids kind of matter as them or something?
No, I don't think it's as simple as giving the dark matter particles a cross-section for point-like scattering. My bet is I would go rather with a fluid with very unconventional properties or a fifth force. Okay, good, good. Fifth force is now Pandora's box is open.
Along those lines, could you clarify whether all the simulations that you've been showing here in comparison with data are only based on Newtonian gravity?
Yes, of course, you raised two questions. First, these all assume conventional standard physics, including the inverse square law for gravity. I do not think we avoid these problems by going to non-Newtonian gravity, but that would be another lecture.
This month's Scientific American had this article about epigram and maybe. Do you have an opinion on that, Milgram?
Well, that is the topic of this discussion. It would be another... another.
He accepts the inverse square law, but not epigram and maybe.
It's the same thing.
Different way of writing.
Question?
Yeah, on the opposite scale from void, you find it... unnerving that we have supermassive black holes in the center of the galaxy, even at fairly high redshift, which if you form them at the same rate you form galaxies have to be done.
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Just so everyone knows that, Sloan Digital Sky Survey can pick up objects point-like, stellar-like, that have weird spectra. Many of these turn out to be quasars. That's an old trick. But they are adept at picking up quasars now at the redshift 6, which means the expansion factor is 7, since these guys were radiating. Spectacular. And these things are enormously luminous, so that by conventional estimates, their masses, a couple times 10 to the ninth, are comparable to the most massive black holes in the centers of nearby galaxies. How the devil did they get there so early? And if they got there so early, and if merging were important, why didn't they grow to be super-duper massive black holes at the present epoch? It's one more argument for early galaxy formation. And furthermore, for some new, well, it is weird. It is weird. I can't resist offering my illustration of why I am not on Milgram's side. I am for Milgram. He should be asking these questions. I admire them. But I think he's got a real problem, simply illustrated by luminous arcs. Here is a cluster of galaxies. The blotches are galaxies in the cluster. The arc is the image of a background galaxy that is about here. Einstein bending of light has given us a distorted image in this arc. Now ask yourself the musical question. If the force law that deflected the light were whatever you choose, and if the source for the force law were at the light, could you get this smooth arc? Forget it. This thing has to be dominated by dark matter. It's in your face.
Yes.
But it really grabs me and causes... There are more arguments, but this is the one that I... This is a treasure.
Gary? I want to make sure I understood your view of merger. I mean, you've argued that data doesn't support a lot of merging of galaxies, and yet you've shown us pictures where there's a lot of galaxies very close together. So are these pairs of galaxies at a different stable?
You know, I forgot to mention one key aspect of merging. But I'll never find it. There are lots of galaxies close together in space. Here is an example of a nearby triplet of galaxies. It's just at about 300 kilometers per second away. is that, of course, in the plane of the local supercluster, there are three galaxies. If you look at this with 21 centimeter, you see that these guys are connected by lovely long swirls of gas. They clearly are orbiting each other. Now, under conventional physics, these will soon merge to make something. What will that remnant be? Conventional ideas are it'll be an elliptical galaxy. There'll be a starburst, and that's it. You'll just get a lump of stars. But it will have the wrong chemistry. Very elegant fact that we needn't get into the details of. These guys have a high ratio of iron to oxygen and carbon because iron is mostly made in these explosive burning of white dwarfs, burning oxygen and carbon to iron. But it takes about 10 to the 9th years for that to happen. In ellipticals, star formation is rapid, so they have a low ratio of iron to oxygen. In spirals like this, there's a high ratio of iron to oxygen because there's lots of time for supernovae that make lots of iron. If you merge these guys to make an elliptical, it's got the wrong chemistry. So the big question is, what is the result of frequent merges of guys like this? The answer is, we don't know. The simple explanation, well, they don't merge very quickly. They just hang around for all eternity. That's not conventional physics, but it seems to answer the need.
David, so you pointed out like a bunch of anomalies.
Yes.
And you suggest that is a sign of some kind of fundamental system.
Yes. Yes.
Do you see, there surely you thought of whether you reflect all the anomalies, is any pattern that points to some element that might help solve all of them?
That has been my dream, but I have not realized it. No, there is no pattern I can see. I'm frustrated. That is this, the radio galaxies. Yeah, it is true that if I cut like so, I would make these lines much longer. You're absolutely right. But this plane was not chosen at random or to fit these data. This is the Devoquelure plane of the local supercluster, chosen before we knew about radio galaxies. It is very important that there was no free degree of freedom here. Perhaps there is a common thread, which I have not pursued, but should be.
Well, just a comment more that one of the great hopes over the next decade is to short circuit a lot of the problems we have with the astrophysics here, and map out the gravitational influence that dominated by the dark matter.
Yes. Yes.
Projected mass density. That might help clear up a lot of these issues.
By going after gravity, one is going after the mass, and that has got to be a lot cleaner in its interpretation, aside from the fact that this is a much weaker signal. It'll certainly be a way to go.
It'll be a hard measure.
Yeah. But
it seems to work in the clusters.
It is striking. Yes. Yes, it works in the clusters.
On the subject between in connecting dark matter distribution and invisible distribution, which don't match up very well, leaning towards it just being very messy physics.
Yes. Yes.
Nothing to figure out. I think a data point towards that is we have these dark gravitational lenses where you can see you can have cluster-sized masses with no visible matter, and mm-hmm. that's such an extreme case, you can't, it's so extreme mm-hmm. in light of other cases where there's a portion of dark and visible, it's showing that there's something going on.
This is really important, but do we have a well-established case of a dark lens? I don't know of any. There have been lots of reports, but perhaps you know of one that is clean.
What's your, and we can talk about this later, but what's your threshold for declaring it a confirmed?
Yes, yes.
Because we can talk about that.
But it is absolutely essential. If we knew that there were galaxies, if there were dark halo concentrations of dark matter that don't have any light in them, it would go a long way to exploring the void phenomenon. I don't know of a clean example where that's so, and I would love to hear about any suggestions you have. Certainly that's one of the things people will be going after in connection with lensing.
We know there can't be that many, though, right?
Well, alas, because we see lots of lensing events and there's always a galaxy sitting there. So, well.
Yeah, exactly. Other questions? No further questions, but thanks.